illustration from what I consider one of the darkest periods in the history of mankind. The Holocaust was an attempt during World War II by the German government that was led by Adolf Hitler to exterminate a race of people, to exterminate from this earth the Jewish race of people. So throughout both Germany and the European nations that they had conquered, if you were Jewish, you were identified, you were forced to wear a yellow star, your home could be confiscated, your businesses confiscated, and in larger cities you were put in ghetto areas, where at a certain time you marched down to the railroad tracks and were loaded on cattle cars. There was no food, there was no water, there was no sanitation, and the doors were shut and the doors were sealed, and off you went. At the other end of the line, you were told that it was a relocation and life would be really good. But when they staggered off the train, they, to their horror, was the acrid smoke of burning bodies, and they stepped into a concentration extermination camp. And some went this way to work until they died, and some went immediately to their death. And it was a familiar pattern: pants here, shirts here, so forth, dresses here. And then you were marched into stalls, and the hissing you heard was not the hissing of water, it was the hissing of gas. If you were in a smaller rural area, they took people out in the country, dug a hole in the ground, and the same procedure, they were stripped and stabbed a few at a time with a machine gun. When I was at the university, I took a course in fascism, and we watched films, and in one film, it looked like a grandmother and maybe her grandson, and he was crying and she was crying, and the machine gunner was having his cigarette before he threw it off and cut them down. And she was pointing up to a God that she must have thought was awfully absent at that moment. And then the machine gun cut them down and they fell into the pit. And the camera followed them, and in her last moments of life, she was stroking that little boy's head. 6 million people. To put that in terms you would really understand it, that is more than the entire population of the state of Colorado were murdered. Now, in Germany at this time, there were thousands of churches and millions of Christians. And what were they doing while this horror was going on? Here's what one man wrote. I lived in Germany during the Nazi Holocaust. I considered myself a Christian. We heard stories of what was happening to the Jews, but we tried to distance ourselves from it, because what could anyone do to stop it? A railroad track ran behind our small church, and each Sunday morning we would hear the whistle in the distance and then the wheels coming over the track. We became disturbed when we heard the cries coming from the train as it passed by. We realized that it was carrying Jews like cattle in the cars. Week after week, the whistle would blow. We dreaded to hear the sound of those wheels because we knew we would hear the cries of the Jews en route to a death camp. Their screams tormented us. We knew the time the train was coming, and when they heard the whistle blow, we began singing hymns. By the time the train came past our church, we were singing at the top of our voices. If we could still hear the screams, we sang even louder, and soon we heard them no more. Years have passed, and no one talks about it anymore. But I still hear that train whistle in my sleep. God, forgive me. Forgive all of us who called ourselves Christians, yet did nothing to intervene. This morning I'm going to talk to you about your job in the world as a Christian, in the church and in the world. I want to give you three introductory reasons why you should consider volunteering your service as a Christian, and why your religion should be a lot more than just sitting in church singing real loud. First of all, I think the Bible presents service as proof that Jesus Christ is a reality in your life. The Lord said, Jerry, what you do with your Christianity is a proof as to whether or not it's real. Look at this verse of scripture on your screen. James said, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but he does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be ye warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it doesn't have works, is dead. Now, I know we can sit in church singing real loud of our love for Jesus Christ, but if we do not serve our church and our world, our love seems really false. I pastored the church in Odessa where Stuart and Randy were on the staff with me for many years. And in the earlier years of the church, we had a young guy in the church, a young husband, father, had a wonderful wife and three daughters, but he had this nasty little habit that some have out in the oil patch. And when he got his check on the weekend, he went out and got slobbering drunk and stayed out most of the night and came in. And in the morning, with lipstick on his collar, woke his wife up and told her where he'd been and what he had done. And she talked to me a couple times, and I said, I don't think there's any way God expects you to stay in a marriage like that. So one day he came home and she was gone, and he came to my office, of course, and sitting across my desk from me, he was sitting there crying and had the absolute audacity to say to me, oh, Jerry, you don't know how much I love her. And I said, you must think I'm an idiot. Of course I know how much you love her. If you'd loved her at all, just a little bit, there's no way you would have treated her the way you treat her. And the Lord Jesus said, look, if you love me, second thing, I think it's really important that you get a responsibility in your church and in your community. Because I think our American culture is marginalizing the Christian faith and the God of the Bible. Some in governmental power, some in the legal system, some in the educational system, and most of the entertainment world are skeptical and many times hostile toward the reality of the God of the Bible, toward the deity of His Son, Jesus Christ, toward biblical faith and biblical morality. And I think you involved in your world makes a great statement that God is real and Jesus Christ is real. Freddie and I have come for years up to Colorado during the heat of the summer. We stayed a lot of times and kind of focused in Dillon, and then we preached for friends like Stuart and Randy when he was at Delta and other young guys that worked with me that are in Colorado now. And when we are not speaking somewhere, we would attend the Dillon Community Church, who in the beautiful amphitheater beside the Dillon Lake had services on Sunday during the summer. And one morning we was there, and the pastor of the church, who was a big, tall guy like me, who was an ex-missionary to Africa, was talking about an experience he had. And he said, I was flying back from Africa to New York, and it's a very, very long flight, and I'm a very tall man, so I really requested a long-legged seat. But said, when I got there, the airline had it all mixed up, and I ended up in a very closed seat at the back of the plane. And then to make it even worse, a family came down the aisle with a whole wad of kids, and I knew where they were going. And he said they were a Muslim family, and they came and they just surrounded me, husband, wife, kids. And he said, I thought, you know, I can sit here and feel sorry for myself, or I could get involved in their life. So he said, that's what I did. I helped them take care of the kids. I played games with the kids. I'd take the kids back to where the restroom was. And I just got involved. I talked to them. I shared my life and my experiences for the trip. And he said, when we landed in New York, this Muslim man said to me, sir, you're the first Christian I've ever met in my life, but I'm impressed with your Jesus because of you. And that's the point I'm trying to make there. And the third reason I challenge you to get involved is because it will change your life and change your church. The growth and quality of any church depends upon the growth and quality of the volunteers who serve. Did you hear me? The growth, the quality of any church. And I'm in a different church for 17 years almost every week. And the happiest churches I find in America are filled with people involved in their church, their community, and their world. In fact, one of the mottos of Focus on the Rockies is connect, commit, serve. And their statement is, serve Jesus Christ in the church and live it out in the world. So let's talk about these three points. First of all, your church needs volunteers. Now, when I was pastoring in Odessa, the church became by far the largest church in the city, so preachers get a lot of credit for stuff like that. So I'd be talking to somebody and they'd say, boy, Jerry, church is really getting big. You got a really big church. You're really doing a great job. You're really great. And my standard answer to that was, yeah, you ought to see how great I am on a Sunday morning when none of the volunteer nursery ladies show up. You ought to see how great I am if none of the voluntary Sunday school teachers show up. You ought to see how great I would be if none of the volunteer musicians showed up. You ought to see how great I would be if none of the ushers showed up. You ought to see how great I'd be if none of the tithers tithed. No, if this church is great, it's great because a whole group of people worked very hard to make it great. And I am aware that the success of that church was and is today dependent upon volunteers. If you read the book of Romans, which is one of the greatest books in the New Testament, and it's a theological treatise, and chapter 8 is one of the great chapters, Romans would say, Watson, and they'd say, well, Watson, he is successful. Priscilla, who risked their life. And say hello to Andronicus and Junia, who were in jail with me. And say hello to Mary. Mary worked so hard. And say hello to Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus is the first person saved when I came to Asia. And I remember when Epaphroditus got saved, I was so excited I couldn't sleep that night. And tell Rufus hello. And say hello to his mother, because she was like a mother to me. Paul would not call that a list. It's the profile of a church. When I was 25 years old, and that's a long time ago, in 1960 ago, kind of wanted to get out on my own and see what I could do. It's an unpainted cinder block building, concrete floors, screwed in the light bulbs, the chairs hooked together, had been thrown away by the Esleta School District. It was on a sand hill. The morning I preached there the first time, there were 40 people that had a $9 offering. And they asked me to come. And God said, that's what I want you to do. So Freddie and I went there and stayed 3.5 years, and the church grew from 40 to near 400. And we built 3 new buildings, including a brand new auditorium. But when we left El Paso to come back to Odessa, where I spent 36 years in pastoring in that church, we left El Paso with a group of people in our hearts. When we got there, Charlie and Bernice Overman, Charlie's in the Air Force, there's the Bliss Air Force Base there, Charlie's big dude. I don't know how he stayed in the Air Force. He was big around as he was tall. And he and Bernice were just, they kids to roll up on the church in an old blue-green Studebaker with 2 kids. And they said, Jerry, we'll take the teens. And we'll bring these young men that are in the service from out at Bliss, and we'll see if the Lord might touch their heart. And they cleaned the church, and they were there every time. They were just simple people. But I loved them to death, and I couldn't have built that church without them. Charlie Overman, God bless him, he sat right over here on the front row and slept through every sermon I preached. In 3.5 years, I never woke him up a single time. And then there was Freddie and Bonnie Elmore. He drove a truck for the Farrah Pants Company. And they were such wonderful people, and God let them buy a new house to them. And it was a big piece of property. There was basketball courts and tennis courts and riding stables and everything. And they asked me to come down as a kid preacher. I thought it was such an honor and just dedicate their home to the Lord. And I remember Freddie telling me and Bonnie, said, Jerry, this is not our home. This is the Lord's home. And if the church needs some place to bring the kids for an activity, you bring them here. And if the church wants to go somewhere and have an activity, you bring them here. This is not our house. This is the Lord's house. Barbara Bennett came to me when I first got there and said, I'll teach the children. I'll do a good job. I'll work with these children. And the first night Freddie and I got there, the church had a little reception after the evening service, and Barbara gave me a little wrapped gift. And I said, well, Barbara, that's nice. And I opened it up, and it was Tums, aspirin, and Pepto-Bismol. That was what was in the deal. And I said, Barbara, what does this mean? She said, that's what you're going to need to pastor this church. And she was right. And Freddie and I won Frank and Rita Anderson. He was a fireman, later became a fire chief. Won them to Jesus Christ. His full name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt Anderson. His little brother was Winston Churchill Anderson. And Frank got in the church and really went to work for the Lord. And his old daddy came to see one of the kids baptized. And Frank was so burdened for his daddy being saved that we pushed those little ratty pews apart and knelt with his daddy in an aisle and won his daddy to Jesus Christ. And I baptized him the next Sunday night in a pair of flannel pajamas. And I said, Mr. Anderson, why did you name him Franklin Delano Roosevelt Anderson, and why Winston Churchill Anderson? He said, Preacher, we had 17 kids. We just ran out of names before we got to the last. And one Sunday morning, Lib Winters walked up to me and she said, Jerry, would you come out and visit my husband? And I'm going to tell you before you come, he's one of the meanest men in the lower valley of El Paso. He shuts down the bars almost seven nights a week. And he's pretty rough with me and the kids. And he's big and rough. And he's got a wooden leg down here because he was in a drunk wreck and lost his leg below his knee. He's got a wooden leg there. And I don't know how he'll treat you. So I took Freddie with me in case the situation got nasty. But she took Lib and the girls and went inside. And I sat beside a little stone fence out there and talked to Charlie about Jesus Christ. I'm a kid preacher. I got a crew cut. I weigh about 140 pounds. And I'm scared to death all the time anyway because it was my first church. And I'm sitting there with Charlie telling him about Jesus. And he's telling me how sorry and mean and what he did in the war and how he drinks and how he treats his wife. And God doesn't want to save somebody like me. But aren't you glad in Isaiah? Isaiah said, though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. And I read that to Charlie, and he accepted it. And we knelt beside that little stone fence, and Charlie prayed and asked Jesus Christ. And God changed his life. Started wearing a suit, coming to church on Sunday. I baptized him. We had a little steel Baptist where he could barely get in. Charlie took off that wooden leg and hobbled down. He was taller than me and about twice as wide, and there I stood. And he looked down at me and said, kind of disdainfully, he said, preacher, you think you can do this? And I said, Charlie, I think I can get you under. But I don't know from there on where we're going. I mean, you may take me under with you. You know something? Don't call that a list. Freddie and I would not call that a list. These are the people that we wouldn't have made it in that little church in El Paso. And we still love them all very much. I can tell you where they all live. I talk to them all the time. They're a part of our heart because they love Jesus and love the church. Then we went to El Paso and stayed 36 years. And when we left there, I had a list. And I mean, there's hundreds there. But I remember Doris Kuntz. These names will be familiar to Stuart and Christy. When our church got larger, she would have over 100 kids. She taught the first grade, was the superintendent of the first grade department for over 30 years. She would have over 100 kids a Sunday. 30 years. And Truett and Joyce Filon were in the second grade, 2,340 Sundays, over 45 years. Every Sunday they were teaching second grade. And I was very involved in the communities I'll mention a little later, so I did a lot of memorial services, and three of the ladies of the church, Hazel Freeman, Penny Turner, and Myrna Evans came to me and said, because our church fed the people at the church on the day of the funeral. And they said, Jerry, you know, you have to work. We'll take care of that. You just tell us how many will be there. And I dressed up in my suit for the memorial, would go over before the service, and there are those ladies. The tables would be nice, flowers on the table. The food would be there. The family would come in. They would welcome them, fill their tea glasses, walk around. I'd walk in, and one of them would be sitting crying with a mother who had lost her husband or a child, and they were just incredible people. And there was Jim Newsom, who got saved and became one of our ushers, one of these remarkable guys that could remember everybody's name. And Curtis Poole was so smart, he was a member of Mensa. He only came to church because he was dating a girl in the church, and she wouldn't date him unless he came to church. And he would sit there with arms folded and glared at me while I preached. And one morning I talked on the grace of God. It's not what you do, it's what God does. And Curtis came up and accepted the Lord. And then he said, I want to do something in the church. And I thought, as smart as he was, he'd want to be in leadership. He said, no, I want to work on a bus. Let me go out and pick up kids. Let me bring kids to the Lord so they're not 50 years old before they get saved. I would mention one more. Joe Crouch, God love her, she's in heaven now, came. She stuttered like crazy. I would like to teach. We gave her a class in the 4 years old. I don't know how much courage it comes when you stutter and say, I want to teach little kids. But however much courage it did, she said, God said this to me. And she went in there and made an amazing discovery. When she talked to me, she stuttered. When she talked to those kids, she spoke like an angel. That's not a list. None of these people are in the Christian Hall of Fame, but they're in my Hall of Fame. And I'll guarantee you, Stuart and Randy and their families and David and the people who work here at the church have a list also. And my challenge to you is get on that list. Get something in this church the church will never mean as much to you until you have a reason to come down here and a way you serve and something you do that makes a difference. Get a class with little children. I began, after I got saved, I became superintendent of the 9, 10, and 11-year-old boys and girls. And I loved them. Because the boys hated the girls and the girls hated the boys. I had all the contest material in the whole world. I just all the time ran the boys and the girls and they'd kill each other trying to beat the boys or beat the girls. I loved working with those children. If I were here, I would take a class and work with children or work in the nursery or be an usher or get involved in music, but do something that makes a difference and makes your church so much better. You say, well, Jerry, I don't know much about the Bible, and I'm not really all. Whoa. I read once that the woods would be silent if no birds sang except the birds who seem to be authorities. No, we're just sinners saved by grace. Lord, give me a job in the church. Let me have something to do that makes a difference for Jesus Christ. Then point two. Your community needs volunteers. The first President Bush, in his inauguration speech, called for Americans to be a kinder and gentler nation by being 1,000 points of light. So I want to challenge you to be a point of light for Jesus Christ in this church and your community. Jesus challenged you a long time before I did. He told the story of the Good Samaritan. A Jewish man is going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and it is down, and he fell among thieves who beat him almost to death, stripped him of all his clothes, left him naked and dying beside the road. And the Lord said three people came by. First was a priest. That's a guy in religious leadership who looked at him and walked by on the other side of the road. And you could have said, sir, whoa, why didn't you help him? He needed to told you all the reasons he was so busy he needed to get to Jericho. And the next is a Levite. That's someone involved in church life. And he came and looked on him. And then he left. And you'd say, why didn't you help the guy? And he'd said, but I have something in Jericho. I must be there. The third was a Samaritan. He was of a different race of people. The Bible said he came and he saw him and his heart went out to him. He had compassion on him and he poured oil and wine in his wounds and picked him up and put him on his own beast and took him to an inn and said, you take care of him and here's some money and I'll come back by and if you need more money, you take care of him. And then Jesus said this, it's on your screen. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among robbers? And the lawyer said, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said, you go and you do likewise. You get involved in your community. Now at Odessa, I mean, we had a large church and there were, I think, 11 or 12 guys on the staff when I left. I had plenty to do, but I was also the police chaplain who recruited 30 other pastors to help the police and the fire, anybody that needed us as chaplains. I was also the chaplain of the Mojo football team, Permian, who was the winningest program in Texas for the 70s, 80s, and part of the 90s. I was there for 25 years as their chaplain, took time. I was a member of the Downtown Lions Club. I was on the board of the Salvation Army. I was on the board of the United Way and several others. And I'm not bragging about anything. I'm just saying I'm not preaching to you something I wasn't willing to do. See, there's a place for you to make a difference and shine a light for Jesus Christ. Coaching, these kids come some from horrible homes. If they have a man or a woman just coaching their little leaguers, some of their teams that just loves them and is kind, wow. And volunteer at the hospital and get in a civic club and nursing homes. And do you ever go to a nursing home and say, is there anybody here that nobody visits? Is there someone here that a family is just warehousing them? Could I go see them? You ever understand what light you could bring to their light for Jesus Christ? Domestic violence, meals on wheels, hurting people. I read of two golfers who paused one day while they were golfing, and one said to the other, I would like to ask God why he allows poverty, injustice, and hunger when he could do something about it. And his friend said, well, why don't you ask God that? And he said, well, because I'm afraid God would ask me the same question. Why do I allow poverty and hunger and injustice when I can do something about it? I challenge you to have a job in the church. I challenge you to be a light for Jesus Christ in your community. And last, your world needs volunteers. For you sports guys, Jim Harbaugh was featured in an article in Sports Illustrated. He coached the Stanford Cardinals, the San Francisco 49ers to a Super Bowl, and now is the coach of the Michigan Wolverines. He's Catholic by faith, and he said, every year I go on a mission to Peru. He said, I get face to face with poverty. And Coach Harbaugh said, to me, it has been life altering. I know this church goes to Dominican. I know even back when Randy was working with us, he took kids to Juarez and they do that. And I know you support missionaries. I'm just challenging you to consider sometime going with them. Go with Stu, go with Randy, go to where people are poor. Let me hasten and tell you an illustration. I was invited to go down to Mexico, Ciudad Monte, to a Bible college there that has trained hundreds and hundreds of young Mexican men and women to represent Jesus Christ in that wonderful nation. And so I came and spoke at the graduation, and the preacher said, God bless him, he's been there forever, and the missionary, and he has built 75 churches within a 100-mile radius of Monte. He's put 75 churches pastored by young men from his college. You talk about incredible work. So he wanted to show me the churches, and we went here, and there'd be this beautiful little building and this wonderful Mexican couple, and people would come out, and we'd go here, and we'd been most of the day, and he said, I got one more place I want you to go. And I said, Jerry, these are the poorest people you've ever seen in your life. They're right by a river, and there's not a hope, but they're just the poorest people. But they've got a little congregation, and I got a young preacher boy there. So we went, and the people came from the houses, and the young preacher and his wife, and I'm standing there, and you know, I said, I don't see a building. He said, well, they don't have a building. You see this hard piece of ground? That's their building. He said, see that little shack over there? They get the chairs out on Sunday and put them there and have a little pulpit stand, and this is when they have their church on Sunday and Wednesday night. I'm pastoring a church in Odessa. It's on 4 full city blocks of downtown Odessa. We're out of debt and got money in the bank, and I'm standing there with a group of God's people who just have a hard piece of ground. And I noticed a pile of rocks, and I said, the missionary, I don't understand, why are these rocks? And he said, well, Jerry, these people are very poor, but they've got great faith. And he said, after every service, they walk down to the river that ran through their little village, and they pick up those river rocks, and they come back, and they put them down, and they hold hands, and they pray that God will someday help them put those rocks in concrete so that they could have a building. And I'm just standing there bawling. And I told him, I said, I know our church, so you just tell these people God just answered their prayer. And I went home and I told the church about it. We raised the money that day, and we sent the money down and said, pour the floor and get all the material, and I'm going to bring a busload of guys, and we're going to come down, men and women, and we're going to build that building. And they came down there and built that building that week, and there it stands. And I talked to him the other day, and he said, they're running 75 in that little building. You know why that happened? Because I stood there and saw it, and my heart was so moved. It will change you. It will change the place you go. So this is my challenge to you this morning. Because you see, guys, we've all got a choice about how we're going through life as Christians. Whether we're just going to sing real loud or we're going to make a difference. So some say, oh, we need to have a campaign. We need to have some kind of a... No, maybe not. Maybe we need to do this. Here's the last verse on the screen. This is Jesus speaking. The harvest is plentiful. There was a trainload of people on their way to an extermination camp. You've got a city full of people on their way to an eternal destination. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers, Jesus said, are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest that he will send out laborers into his harvest. So I'm going to challenge you to do, in the last few minutes before Stuart comes, what Jesus asked us to do. And I'm going to challenge us to pray. In a moment, I'm just going to ask you to stand. There's something special, church. There's something special as you pray. I mean, somebody can pray, but for us to pray as a body of Christ. Somebody may want to come down here and kneel. It's a beautiful place here at the front. Or you may just want to pray where you stand. Whatever you choose to do. But I'm going to give you a few minutes while David plays, and you just pray. And two things. First of all, pray the Lord of the harvest that he will bless. Focus on the Rockies. Why can't you double? Why can't this church be a lighthouse with the music and the people you've got to this entire city? I want you to pray for your church, and then I also want you to pray for you. And I want you to be honest and say, God, what do you want me to do? I need to do something in my church and in my world, and just ask God, Lord, send me into the harvest. Would you do it? I know it's easy just to sit there, but I'm hoping a lot of you will just come and pray, and then we'll have Stuart come. Let's stand together. And while our heads are bowed, would you please pray to the Lord of the harvest, wherever you would like to pray, that he would use you in the harvest. What's your job? What's your responsibility?
God, I just ask that we as a church collectively and we as individuals who are believers in Jesus Christ would respond to your clear desire for us to serve in your name. This